You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 6th of January 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us a geopolitical analyst, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rusjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. Happy New Year. How are you doing?
Well, Happy New Year to you too. I think it's going to be good. I think it'll be good for both of us. Today's Christmas Eve too, don't forget, on the old calendar. And we get the best deals on Christmas presents when you buy them in January rather than December. So I don't know. It's still a little warm out for me, but still things are looking up.
Well, I had forgotten that. Merry Christmas to you as well as Happy New Year then, Matt. And yes, let's hope that it's a better year this year than last year. It's actually started off well. There's an advertisement for Radio Albion on Sam Hyde's podcast, which I got told about the other day. Quite an expensive advert for Radio Albion there. So that's definitely a good start to the new year. Well, getting into what we're going to be discussing today, we're going to be talking about the Soleimani assassination 2 years on. And listeners will remember this. When it happened, it was absolutely shocking. The car was in flames and lots of people were injured. And the guy was actually on a diplomatic mission. And it's all gone quiet since then. We haven't really talked about him. We did a podcast on the event when it actually occurred. And what we have here today is a report from Pepe Escobar. And he says, 2 years ago, the 2020 started with a murder. Baghdad Airport, January the 3rd at 052 hours. The assassination of Major General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Al-Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, alongside Abu Mahdi al-Mudandis, deputy commander of Iraq's Hashd al-Shabi forces, by laser-guided AGM-114 Hellfire missiles launched from two US MQ-9 Reaper drones, was an act of war. This act of war set the tone for the new decade and inspired my book Raging Twenties, Great Power Politics Meets Techno-Feudalism, published 1 year later. The drone strikes at Baghdad Airport, directly approved by then US President Donald Trump, were unilateral, unprovoked, and illegal, an imperial act engineered as a stark provocation capable of triggering an Iranian reaction that would then be countered by American self-defense, packaged as deterrence. The imperial narrative barrage spun it as a targeted killing, a preemptive operation squashing Soleimani's alleged planning of imminent attacks against US diplomats and troops. But no evidence whatsoever was provided to support this claim. And then Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi, in front of Parliament, offered the ultimate context. Soleimani, on a diplomatic mission, had boarded a regular Chamwings Airbus A320 flight between Damascus and Baghdad. He was involved in complex negotiations between Tehran and Riyadh, with the Iraqi Prime Minister as mediator, and all of that at the request of President Trump. And that's absolutely disgusting, isn't it? President Trump got this guy Soleimani to come out there as a peacemaker on a diplomatic mission, and Soleimani trusted him, and then President Trump had him assassinated. I mean, what sort of an example does this set to the rest of the world? I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. I think this was one of the worst things that Trump actually did during his presidency. What do you make of all of this and what Pepe Escobar has to say here, Matt?
Well, his outrage is right. Soleimani has done absolutely nothing wrong. He doesn't threaten the U.S. although to some limited extent, he does threaten the imperial forces in the region who have no right to be there. And Trump has admitted that this was all for the sake of Israeli security. He was going to risk a massive war with an extremely powerful first world power in Central Asia for the sake of Israel. And what always makes me laugh about it is that when Biden was quote unquote elected, one of the first people to congratulate him was Netanyahu, despite the fact that a lot of Trump's policies led to his reelection. So, you know, there's no thanks there. And they never trusted him. They don't like him. But his foreign policy was the weakest part of his agenda. And luring this guy here, who really is an anti-imperial fighter, for treaties between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which in and of itself did threaten the U.S., but Saudi Arabia is an American ally, luring them there and then destroying them, that's an outrage, especially since the conditions with the Iraqi government, the conditions under which the U.S. forces are permitted to stay and function in Iraq were violated. There's no further military action permitted there, and certainly not against allied powers. Remember, Iraq is a Shiite power to a great extent too. And they're obviously going to be allied with Iran, whether the U.S. wants it or not. So whether it be the refusal to notify Congress, which they didn't do, which they have to do legally, the unilateralism of the whole thing, and the fact that this was an act of terror doesn't seem to bother anybody. And yeah, you're right. It did just get swallowed up. No one talked about it anymore. It was a complete disaster, and it backfired on everybody.
Oh, it was a naked act of terror. This guy had diplomatic immunity, and he was under the protection of Iraq. And then America, and also acting on the orders of America, trying to do what America wanted him to do, to go there and act as a peacemaker. And then they assassinate him. So the imperial machine, following trademark mockery of international law, assassinated a de facto diplomatic envoy. In fact, two envoys, because al-Muhandis had the same leadership qualities as Soleimani, actively promoting synergy between the battlefield and diplomacy, and absolutely irreplaceable as a key political articulator in Iraq. Soleimani's assassination had been encouraged since 2007 by US neocons supremely ignorant of West Asian history, culture and politics, and the Israeli and Saudi lobbies. Both the Bush Jr. and Obama administrations resisted it, afraid of an inevitable escalation. Trump could not possibly see the big picture and its dire ramifications when he had only Israel firsters of the Jared of Arabia Kushner variety whispering in his ear, in tandem with close pal Saudi crown princeling Mohammed bin Salman. So do you think Mohammed bin Salman had much to do with this? I mean, you're alleging there that it was basically Israel that got him to do this, Matt. How does Mohammed bin Salman feature in this?
Well, the IDF already admitted it. General Hyman was the person who did it. Salman is, of course, an ally of the U.S. and Israel, which is a shocking development. He had to have known about it. And therefore, Saudi intelligence had to have known about this operation. And not only did he kill Soleimani, but, you know, the commander of the Iraqi militia as well. An outrage. And this is one of the things where the Iraqi government said, we want the U.S. out permanently. And so that turns out to be a massive humiliation. But I love it when he says here, the supremely ignorant of West Asian history. And it's absolutely true. I've been talking about this for a long time. They don't really know much. All they know is that American corporations should be permitted to invest freely in the region and profit and destroy the economies of everyone else and make it an American satrapy. And the axis of resistance, of which Iran is a part of it, exist to fight that, not to mention Zionism, which is a big part of the liberal agenda in that part of the world. So that's the final goal, is just to make it just a McDonald's of McDonald's in every corner. That's the point of it. So, you know, they're in the right to fight this thing. And Trump got nothing but the Zionist stuff whispered in his ear. He's not particularly knowledgeable on foreign policy. This is a huge weakness. He wasn't even a political guy until he ran for office. And so he was really at the mercy of his advisors, and it was a disaster.
Well, he made one foreign policy mistake after the other, didn't he? But I seem to remember the Iraqis, didn't they have a democratic vote to remove the Americans from Iraq? And that was a couple of years ago. I think I remember we covered that. What am I remembering there, Matt, and what happened from that? Did they vote to remove the Americans?
They did. We had a show about that. And if you remember, we had a show about this. We had a show about the Soleimani murder 2 years ago. And but now we're going to get into what we're going to deal with here is the fallout. But the constant lying. You know, every time the U.S. has one of these operations, they invent some kind of ridiculous cover story. And the most maddening thing about politics these days is that people forget about the last lie and take the new lie seriously. And then the new lie is exposed as a lie. Then they condemn everyone else but themselves. And people like me and you are some of the first to expose it. And ultimately then, this means that the neocons are able to manipulate people into engaging in these Zionist policies that have no possible interest for the United States, Europe, North America, or any other place. These exist solely to support Israeli and corporate interests.
Well, as you point out, the fallout from this, the response to this, is very interesting. The measured Iranian response to Soleimani's assassination was carefully calibrated to head off vengeful, unrestrained imperial overkill. Precision missile strikes on the US-controlled Ain al-Assad airbase in Iraq, and the Pentagon received advance warning of this. Yet it was precisely that measured response that turned out to be the game changer. Tehran's message made it graphically clear that the days of imperial impunity were over. We can hit your assets anywhere in the Persian Gulf and beyond at the time of our choosing. So this was the first miracle that the spirit of Soleimani engineered. The precision missile strikes on Ain al-Assad represented a middle rank power enfeebled by sanctions and facing a massive economic and financial crisis, responding to a unilateral attack by targeting imperial assets that are a part of the sprawling empire of bases. And that was clearly interpreted across West Asia and vast swathes of the global south as fatally piercing the decades-old hegemonic armor of US prestige. Now, I seem to remember them doing this. They did give a warning, didn't they? I mean, to the Americans, it's just like, well, we've removed all the technology and the equipment from there, so it was just a bit of concrete that they hit. And I believe this was some weeks after the assassination. I mean, it really didn't seem that important to me. It just seemed like, well, that they were going to respond, and they obviously came out with some kind of an arrangement. This is the way we're going to respond, and then we'll leave it at that. It seemed to me that they were doing this just to save face. But what Pepe Escobar is saying here is that it was something more than that. So can you expand on it for us, Matt, please?
Oh, I definitely agree. I don't believe they were enfeebled by sanctions. And a middle-ranked power, I think, is probably correct. But I think sanctions have had a minimal effect on Iran, since that the economy, the Iranian economy, is faces east and north, not west. And of course, the financial crisis. Who isn't facing a massive financial crisis other than China and Russia? But the Iranian economy is far better than the American economy as far as that's concerned. But the U.S., of course, they always lie about their casualties. That goes for every war. You usually double or triple the casualties of what the Pentagon says in Iraq or in Afghanistan. They started off by saying that there were no casualties. Then they said there were 17. And then the number continued to grow until now. I think it's 119. And then Donald Trump said there's a few who were hospitalized for headaches. Military guys hospitalized for headaches. Turns out a few of them did have traumatic brain injuries from the attacks. So they couldn't have had that much advance warning such that they got troops out of there. That may have been a bit overdrawn. And it wasn't expected. It wasn't expected with that level of precision. And it was a long distance hit. And yes, it did impress and frighten the West. And there was no response to it.
Or wasn't there another attack on a Saudi oil refinery? Or do we not know who was actually responsible for that? Do you know the one I'm thinking about, where the Saudi oil refinery went up in flames? Do you think that was Iran?
Well, we did do a show on that. And we actually were talking about pictures of the little hole in one of the big tanks. But I don't think it was anything. I think the Saudis were claiming that there was an attack and there wasn't. I think we came to that conclusion that there really wasn't much of an attack and that the Saudis were just crying wolf for the sake of American support. And which is, by the way, one of the big shocks of the last 10 years is how Saudi Arabia, which used to finance all the anti-Zionist movements in the Middle East, now has become an ally of Mossad. But yeah, that attack, I mean, there's always attacks like this. And if it's anybody, if it wasn't Iran, it may have been one of the militias. But whatever it was, it wasn't particularly successful. And I think the Saudis wildly exaggerated it.
So it wasn't anything like this this attack on the airbase then. Well, let's have a look at some of Soleimani's achievements. Everyone, not only along the axis of resistance, Tehran, Baghdad, Damascus, Hezbollah, but across the global south, has been aware of how Soleimani led the fight against ISIS in Iraq from 2014 to 2015, and how he was instrumental in retaking Tikrit in 2015. In an extraordinary interview, Hezbollah Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah stressed Soleimani's great humility, even with the common people, the simple people. Years before the assassination, Soleimani had already envisaged an inevitable normalization between Israel and the Persian Gulf monarchies. At the same time, he was also very much aware of the Arab League's 2002 position, shared among others by Iraq, Syria and Lebanon, that this normalization cannot even begin to be discussed without an independent and viable Palestinian state under 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. Soleimani saw the big picture all across West Asia, from Cairo to Tehran, from the Bosphorus to the Bab al-Mendab. He had certainly calculated the inevitable normalization of Syria in the Arab world, as well as the timeline followed by the Empire of Chaos to abandon Afghanistan, though probably not the extent of the humiliating retreat and how that would reconfigure all bets from West Asia to Central Asia. Well, if he was this good at working out everything that's going to happen, then clearly he was a key player. And, you know, I mean, he would be seen as a legitimate enemy to the West if he was that good at sort of forecasting what was going on. Don't you think, Matt?
But that's not the example that they used. They claimed in the Trump administration, and the Israelis claimed that there was an imminent attack, and that was the exact phrasing, on American forces in Iraq and elsewhere in the Persian Gulf. And of course, that was a lie. The timeline there of the few months after that assassination went from an imminent attack to a deterrent attack, then not even a deterrent attack. And it really, it's been totally debunked. Even the Israelis say that there was no attack being planned. It was humiliating for the U.S., but people don't really follow that to that extent. It wasn't there was no planned attack whatsoever. And so then Trump eventually said, well, he fought American and Israeli interests in general over the years. Therefore, that's the reason for the attack. But claiming then it's a defensive attack or even a deterrent attack falls apart. So it was simply murder.
So he was actually an expert strategist, and he was also a hero in the fight against ISIS. It is not hard to see Soleimani already envisaging what happened this past month. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu went to Dubai and signed quite a few trade deals with deep political significance, sort of burying a visceral intra-Sunni rivalry. Abu Dhabi's Mohammed bin Zayed seems to be betting simultaneously on an Israel Emirates free trade deal and a detente with Iran. His security advisor, Sheikh Tahnoon, met with Iran's President Raisi in Tehran in mid-December, even discussing Yemen. So what's being referred to here with this deal with Turkey and Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Israel Emirates, Matt?
Well, for a long time, the Emirates, whether it be Bahrain or the UAE, Qatar, didn't like the Iranian revolutionaries. They were different for, you know, they were Sunni, the Iranians were Shiite, et cetera. But that's changing. And one of the reasons it's changing is because the U.S. is no longer a viable partner. The American economy is falling to pieces. No one trusts the dollar. You know, that's no one. And certainly after what happened in Afghanistan, you know, I called that in 2019 that the U.S. is going to be pulling out of Afghanistan very soon. And that humiliation caused these people to rethink their foreign policy. So these trade deals have to do with, you know, Israel is considered a partner, but only so much as it's normalized a trade deal with Iran, which, of course, Israel will never go along with. But the very fact that they're approaching the Iranians, and Iran has a strong economy. Iran has a strong education system. Iran has a strong education system for Islam. So they can't be ignored anymore. And the U.S., of course, always imposing social liberalism on everybody. These Islamic states can't handle it. You know, they're doing everything they can. The U.S. is doing everything, and corporate America is doing everything it can to water down the Islam in these parts of the world. They're overplaying their hand, and the U.S. just is such a weak position, especially after the retreat from Afghanistan and their defeat, because they've been defeated everywhere. But they have such a weak hand to play now, and they claim that I've been saying this before. You know, it's like a man who was a billionaire, used to own a huge corporation. He loses everything. And he still goes to corporate headquarters and starts ordering people around because he can't get it through his head that he doesn't have power anymore. That's what the U.S. is like. And as a result of that, you know, the Iranians under sanctions are approaching these other powers looking for deals, and they're getting them. Even the Turks are involved. When we've been saying that for a long time, it's just a matter of time before Turkey is kicked out of NATO, which would be fine by them. So that's what's happening here, and Israel is fuming. The U.S. and therefore liberalism is losing on every front.
So this attack on Soleimani certainly didn't work. New alliances are being formed, and it does look as if Soleimani was playing the long game, and so are some of these other countries around him or their representatives. But the key issue in all these dealings is a breakthrough land transit corridor that may run between the United Arab Emirates, Iran, and Turkey. Meanwhile, Qatar, a privileged interlocutor of both Turkey and Iran, is engaged in financing the costs of the Gaza administration in a delicate balance with Israel that somewhat replays a similar role by Doha in the negotiations between the US and the Taliban. What Soleimani could not accomplish side by side with al-Muhandis was to set a viable Iraqi path after the inevitable imperial retreat, even though their assassination may have accelerated the popular drive for the definitive expulsion of the Americans. Iraq remains deeply divided and hostage to petty provincial politicking. Still, the Soleimani spirit persists when it comes to the axis of resistance. Tehran, Baghdad, Damascus, Beirut, faced with massive imperial subversion, still surviving every possible challenge. Iran is increasingly solidified as the key node of the new Silk Roads in Southwest Asia. The Iran-China Strategic Partnership, boosted by Tehran's accession to the SCO, will be as strong geo-economically as geopolitically. In parallel, Iran, Russia, and China will all be involved in the reconstruction of Syria, complete with BRI projects ranging from the Iran-Iraq-Syria Eastern Mediterranean Railway to, in the near future, the Iran-Iraq-Syria gas pipeline, arguably the key factor that provoked the US proxy war against Damascus. So there's lots to get into here. I mean, the first bit here is this land transit corridor between the UAE, Iran, and Turkey. What's going on there, Matt?
Well, this has been in the works for a while, but it was accelerated by the assassination and situation in Iraq. This article was published just yesterday or 2 days ago. And I can't stress, I mean, we could have done the entire show just on this section, because this is the economic foundation of everything. This is the proof that, you know, nationalism and regionalism is winning over liberalism. Is that now with the Silk Road and the trillions of dollars in investment that China and Russia are putting into this, now is going to link all of these countries under the, to some extent, under the aegis of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is what the SCO refers to. I'm the only one especially on our side, talking about this at any in any depth, their economy is now going to be totally unaffected by sanctions. Sanctions aren't going to work when your markets now have shifted to the east, where your oil money is going to the Chinese, and now possibly even the Afghans. You know, the kids force under Soleimani, a lot of their financing comes from Chinese banks. And that's not even a classified idea. You know, the external military force of Iran is underwritten by China. And as he says, they're involved in the reconstruction of Syria, the reconstruction and the construction of the Crimea in Russia. This is incredible. This is a total economic victory. And the U.S. is mired in debt, no morale, a deeply divided population, insane social policy, and that these people with a strong nationalist fervor and irrational fervor are cutting the U.S. And the Israelis out of everything. What the Israeli response to this is going to be is going to be interesting. I have the feeling they may do whatever they can now just to drag the U.S. into an all-out war, but I'm not sure how popular it's going to be in Congress.
Well, it's interesting that you got Russia and China that are going in there rebuilding Syria, and of course America was hoping that that was going to be a big bonanza for America to rebuild after destroying the place. Well, was Iran deterred by this? If the principals behind Soleimani's killing bet on Iran's self-deterrence, they miscalculated, as the bombing of the US al-Assad base in Iraq has proven a far more damaging and accurate attack than it was initially considered. In addition, US and Israeli naval warfare against Tehran, intended to stop oil supplies to Syria, has now ceased after Iran's reprisals. Joining the Abraham Accords has not prevented delegations from Riyadh and Abu Dhabi from going to Tehran. These Gulf states both know how vital a non-aggression pact with their neighbour is. They also know that Israel cannot fill the vacuum left by the US partial withdrawal from the region, and they are increasingly at odds with Washington over the depth of the US security commitment. And finally, a new Iranian leadership is changing the country's attitude to nuclear negotiation as it casually disregards any Western pressure against it. Put it all together, and it is difficult to argue that Iran is more deterred now than it was before Soleimani's killing. Well, I don't blame them for having a different attitude towards nuclear negotiation when America just pulled out of the nuclear deal. What do you make of what is being said here, Matt?
Again, he couldn't stress this enough. What he's talking about is not just America's loss in Afghanistan, but the American loss in Syria and elsewhere. That at the attempt to stop oil supplies going to Syria has failed. The Iranians have won on every front without a corresponding counterattack from the West or from Israel. So you have a situation where the Gulf monarchies are making deals. And by the way, the Abraham Accords refer to the deal between the UAE and Israel. We actually had a show about that. But the UAE-Israel deal doesn't preclude the United Arab Emirates from also normalizing their relationships with Iran. This is going to put Israel in a really weird situation. So you'll have a situation where these very wealthy Gulf monarchies are going to be and have free trade deals and most favored nation status with the Iranians, which 20 years ago was inconceivable. And as the U.S. retreats both financially and militarily from the area, where else are they going to go? Iran is the functional hegemon in the area. And I predict a strong resurgence of Shiite identity, even in the western part of the Middle East because of this, and an even stronger Russian presence. This part of the Middle East, you're going to see a stronger Shanghai Cooperation Organization presence. You're going to see Russia being featured far more. It's a huge victory beyond anything that we could have considered 10 years ago, largely because of this stupid assassination.
Well, it's certainly going to be a big help to Iran's economy to have free trade deals with its neighbors. Well, Soleimani represented a reliable interlocutor to call to de-escalate moments of crisis. He was the equivalent of the famous telephone number in Europe that Henry Kissinger searched for in the 1970s. In a region that is so volatile, secure and confidential communication channels should be maintained. The IRGC's commander was a master of the region's highly complex and over-nuanced dynamics. When it was necessary, he kept his turbulent proxies under control, and finding a worthy successor has been difficult for Iran, as the latest developments in Iraq have shown. His authority was undisputed, as was his ability to present effectively and quickly any case to his top decision makers in Tehran. The void he left has not been filled. Any serious professional involved in the shadowy world of intelligence and asymmetric warfare in the Middle East will tell you that a person as important as Soleimani should not have been eliminated. His intrinsic value in maintaining a modicum of stability and in avoiding dangerous miscalculations and escalations outweighed any benefits that could arise from his death. But wasn't that the reason why they did this? Because they wanted to get somebody very important whose position the Iranians would not be able to fulfill? It seems to me as if Pepe Escobar is sort of missing the point in why the Americans went after him. Am I right or am I wrong in thinking that, Matt?
No. I think you're right. I think what he's trying to say is in the interest of peace, he should not have been killed. But if you want a war in the Middle East for the sake of Zionism, then yes, get rid of him. And the point being that he did have control over these Shiite militias. Now, his successor is a guy named Ismail Kani, a much older man who is probably worthy successor, although doesn't have the international prestige in that area that Soleimani did. And so the Quds Force is under in good hands. But no, what he means is that if you wanted peace, Soleimani is your man. If you wanted the militias to come under control and to function rationally, then yes, the last thing you want to do is get rid of him. Now, of course, there's a possibility of that changing, and it's all entirely because of the assassination, which means that giving a pretext for war is exactly what the Americans want. Getting rid of Soleimani makes it possible for some of these groups to attack an American target and therefore give an excuse for war. So he's mixed up in that sense. But you know, they changed everything. And if you take the assassination as well as the defeat in Afghanistan, the humiliation in Iraq, the lying about casualties, how weak the sanctions are, how irrelevant the sanctions are, and how powerful the Iranian economy is, this is, you know, the U.S. is in the worst possible position, meaning that the Israelis are in the worst possible position. No wonder they're talking about the new Khazaria in Ukraine.
So the Iranians just have to sit back and wait, the same as the Russians and the Chinese. Only neophytes like Trump or Israelis who had a short-term interest in conflict generation like Netanyahu could go that far. And if the intent was to push Iran back, they have failed abysmally. In the words of US CENTCOM Commander General Kenneth McKenzie, Iran's missiles have become a more immediate threat than its nuclear program. They hit pretty much where they wanted to hit. They can strike effectively across the breadth and depth of the Middle East. McKenzie chillingly added that Iran had achieved an overmatch capability. That is, it can fire more missiles than its adversaries can shoot down or destroy, making it extremely difficult to check or defeat. Iran's strategic capacity is now enormous, the commander concluded. And that's something you're not going to hear on the mainstream media, is it? About Iran's military capacity is now more than America's in that region. Matt, what are your final thoughts on all of this?
Well, given and you're right about that, of course, you're not going to hear about this. It's too detailed. And the Americans don't want to hear about the humiliation of their country and the absurdity of their leadership. You think of the trillions of dollars that have been squandered and the lives that have been lost since the so-called war on terrorism has began. The soldiers that were involved in August in the killing of Afghan civilians, the drone strike, there are a group of soldiers who were involved in that are not being punished. So they could slaughter people with impunity. No wonder there was no support for the U.S. in Afghanistan. The estimation now is about 350,000 civilian deaths, not through bombing, but through actual gunfire. can be directly blamed on the U.S. and its allies. But as far as they know, I didn't appreciate the missile strike at the time. But as time went by, I began to realize that was an incredible act of military precision. And if the Russians come in and sell them, and I think they already have, the S-500 missile system, which is a shield over that country, they may be completely immune to any attack from the West. The Russian missile shield is far better than what the U.S. is, so the successors to the Patriot missile system is promoting. This is why the Turks want it. This is why even the Saudis are looking to it. The Russians have done much better than the Americans in that respect. So Iran may be completely insulated. It's a very good thing.
It is indeed. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.